Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Walter Mosley, author of Every Man a King. It is his second novel featuring the private detective Joe King Oliver. Walter Mosley is one of the most versatile and admired writers in America and is the author of more than 60 critically acclaimed books that cover a wide range of ideas, genres, and forms. And welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
It's great to be here, man.
So, Walter, your protagonist, Joe King Oliver, is doing work for clients that he really doesn't want to do work for. At least the clients are getting him to do work he really doesn't do want. So he's taken on a billionaire, wants him to find out whether or not a alt-right intellectual is guilty of what he's been accused of. And he's been taken by the U.S. And then his ex-wife, who doesn't like him, he doesn't like her, wants him to help her husband who was in jail. So your protagonist, he's taking on cases he really doesn't want to take on, but feels compelled to.
You know, it's interesting. And it's very hard to talk about the decisions one makes about a book, because the decisions I made about this book, I just started writing it. You know, he's on he's driving, north in Manhattan, and then he turns left and he goes through Central Park, and then he goes here and he goes there, and he ends up at this mansion that overlooks, you know, the Hudson. And yeah, I wrote all that, and I didn't exactly know what I was going to be writing about. I really didn't. But I think unconsciously in my head, you know, the idea that he's going to be hired by the richest man in the world to investigate a kind of clandestine governmental decision to kidnap, bring to America and arrest this guy who represents the alt-right and white supremacy. The idea was, yeah, so anyway, you know, because black people are everywhere. They hired this black detective, and he's supposed to prove that this, you know, this white supremacist didn't do what people say he did, you know, and he's in jail. He's in Rikers Island. And, you know, the idea, because, you know, so many years ago, Joe King Oliver was also in Rikers Island, to make a connection between those two and for them to begin to understand each other is like, it's a really important thing, you know, because my understanding of America today is that there are a whole bunch of so-called white people who believe that they've been mistreated and ripped off by people of other, you know, so-called races. And, you know, And I'm always thinking, so, well, if you understood the situation in its entirety, you would not think that about us. You would be thinking, hey, man, we need to learn from these people. And now, of course, that doesn't exactly happen in this book, but you can see it. And I'm really, you know, I'm really excited to be able to, you know, to have a mystery that exists, like, you know, right on the pulse beat of what's going on in America and maybe the whole world today. And I think across the whole world, you have people, you know, from China to Ukraine to Mongolia, you know, to Watts, people who are confused about who their enemy is.
It's interesting because I interviewed someone years ago that was formerly part of, he was a white nationalist. Mm-hmm. And have reformed himself. And that was an incredibly interesting interview, because what you do with Alfred Xavier, is it Quiller?
Quiller, yeah.
Alfred Xavier Quiller is naturally, you humanize this character and you make us think through why he is who he is, as opposed to painting a one-dimensional cardboard client.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's so important to do, you know, because, you know, Quiller, without giving away any of the plot, replaces hate with love in his life. And, you know, I mean, and this is the thing, you know, this is, you know, what they taught us, you know, when we were kids, or, you know, I'm older than you, but, you know, when I was a kid, and then, you know, you were a kid soon after that, they said, you know, listen, you know, in church, they say, listen, we're fighting for our rights, but we're fighting with love, not with hatred. And that's, it's an extraordinary thing when you realize, hey, number one, I don't have to deal with the horrible feeling of hatred. And at the same time, while I'm loving people, I can make my life better, you know, and that's a part of the story, though. I mean, you might read the whole novel and not think that, but that's what it's about. And I'm so excited about it because, you know, our world can change. Our world can be different. Our world can be better. And spiritually, we can be better with the world getting better. You know, we don't have to suffer to give up. We can gain.
It's like Pandora's box. Hope. There's some hope still.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's some hope. But we have to let the hope out the box. Got to let it out the box.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Cain Oliver, because the first novel came out in 2018, Down the River Unto the Sea. You won the Mr. Writers of America Award for Best Novel. And this was your first protagonist, I believe, that was formerly a police detective.
Yeah.
And you wrote this character in a way that there were things he really liked about being a police detective. And he was really into the brotherhood, even though this novel starts some years after he's gotten out, but he had a traumatic experience, was betrayed and put into Rikers Island and spent 3 months in Rikers Island. So here we are, I think, with this particular novel, the second one in the series, it's been about 13 or 14 years since he's been to Rikers Island. And that's a flashpoint for him. That's a traumatic experience that when he goes to visit Quiller, it has literally a physical reaction.
Yeah.
He has a physical reaction. So talk a bit about writing this trauma into the character from his experience in Rikers Island.
Well, you know, the trauma that Joe has experienced being in Rikers, it's so many things. It's, you know, he's such a good cop. He's trying to do the right thing. I mean, he's not a perfect guy, but he's okay. You know, and he slowly realizes that he's been betrayed by the system that he used to feel that he was a better person. You know, his father was a criminal. He said, I'm going to be good. I'm going to do the law. I'm going to fight for my city, New York City, as a policeman. And when he realizes that he's been betrayed by other cops, put in jail, almost killed. And when he gets in prison, you know, in the previous book, the first thing he realizes is that he was a good man yesterday, and today he's ready to kill people. He said, I've lost everything in hours, of who I am. And
I read it as a critique of the criminal justice system. Not broadly, but like prison changes you. I don't know this from direct experience, but I have close folks who have been there.
Uh-huh.
And it changes you. It can dehumanize you. And the United States, I think we have more prisoners than China and Russia put together.
Right. And less people. I mean, no, I mean, people are going to prison. I mean, it's a system. It's a system that, you know, like as you're getting out of, you know, high school, you know, you're going to go this way or you're going to go that way. And nobody seems to care about it. You know, I mean, it's really awful. And in the most clear way to explain, it's completely illegal. I mean, it's completely illegal. What's happening, you know, to American citizens, you know, black and white, poor and poor, like they're all, you know, being shoveled into the system and then being marked by it. It's like the mark of Cain, You know, that once you go to prison, yeah, try to get a job. I knew this guy once he'd been in prison, got all these different degrees while he was in there. And I said, man, that's great. You can get any kind of job. He said, no, man, I can't get any kind of job because I've been in prison. I got that stuff in prison, you know. And you think, wow, there's no life. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people think, well, everybody going to prison is they're crazy murderers. Well, there are very few crazy murderers in prison. You know, most people, you know, somebody was, you know, if they're women, they were kiting checks, you know, there might have been a robbery or dealing of drugs or man, stealing money from a bank, you know, any of those things. And you think, well, we need to forgive people and give them an ability to make a life for themselves, you know. And, you know, all of that, I think, in this new novel comes out, though most of it is about, you know, my main character and his investigation, which, you know, I have so much fun with.
And he has a little bit of fun during his investigation, too, I notice. It's not all beat him up, shoot him up. You've given him some opportunity to have some fun, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. And he has autonomy. He's, you know, this one, the great thing, you know, I mean, the noir genre is an existentialist genre. And so it's a person thinking it's me making the decision to do right. That's important. Not you telling me what to do, not you making me do something, but me making the decision. And once I see what's the right thing, I'm going to do it no matter what anybody says. And, you know, it's a fun notion. And to have a Black protagonist in that position is really fun.
And he has a beautiful relationship with his daughter, Asia Denise, who's in college. She works at his office. And what's interesting about it is you have her reading Franz Fanon, not Wretched of the Earth, but Black Skin, White Masks.
Yeah.
So she is a character that doesn't just read in the present, but also looks to the past, which I thought was pretty interesting because trying to get my 17-year-old to read books written 50 years ago might be a challenge.
Yeah, well, you know, and of course, we're all one of the great things about, you know, living. Yeah, you know, humans are kind of semi-social creatures. And so no one of us can do everything. No one of us can know everything. So, like, you know, you got, you know, one guy, maybe he's doing music, you know, very contemporary, very, you know, out and in the world. But, you know, if he meets Asia Denise, man, he's going to be with her. And, you know, she said, well, you know, I've been reading this book, White Skin, Black Mask. And he'll be saying, well, what is that? You know, there's a way that, you know, you don't need everybody to have done this. You need somebody to do it. And then somebody else to love them. And that's all that's necessary.
But all the hope of all of my peers, where we all read all these books, the autobiography of Malcolm X, the Chester Himes books, the Ralph Ellison books, the Richard Wright's books. We always want our kids to appreciate some of that literature that we found, you know, intellectually stimulating. But I want to jump to the title of the book and the billionaire Roger Ferris.
Okay.
Because the title of a book is Every Man a King. And I'm from Louisiana.
Ah, so you know what it means.
Huey P. Long. Share right. Our wealth. Governor of Louisiana, 1928 to 1932. You know, we had to learn this, by the way. We had to take Louisiana history. U.S. Senate in the 1930s and then assassinated when it looked like he was going to be running for president against. And I don't know if there's any connection, but he was going to run for president against Roosevelt. And he was an interesting character because he was corrupt, but also would put policy in place to help the common man. It was very corrupt.
What did he say? He said, every Black person in Louisiana, as far as my concern, every Black person in Louisiana can vote, long as they vote for me. You know, it's like, I just love it. You know, I mean, yeah, Huey Long was something else.
Why the title?
Well, number one, Joe King Oliver is named after the cornetist mentor
from
of
New Orleans, right? Yeah. Louis Armstrong mentor. Yeah.
And so that's the first historical connection. And then you have, well, the word king and a sense of equality. I think that he's looking He's not looking to, you know, work up or be equal to somebody above him. He's offering equality. He's offering, you know, this is the level playing field. I'm the level playing field. And so, you know, to say every man a king is indeed, you know, to talk about and of course, when you start talking about white supremacists, I mean, you know, Huey Long comes out of that tradition. Okay. I mean, the guy who shot him because, well, at least he said, because Huey Long said his grandfather was a black man, you know, which completely destroyed his political career. And that's why he killed him. At least that's what they say, he killed him. And, you know, and you got to go, wow, you know, this is dealing, you know, in that whole whirlwind of class struggle, of racial inequalities, all of that stuff, you know, and then you have Joe coming in and say, well, every man a king. That's the title for me.
And I'm thinking about Roger Ferris and what he's doing with this company, right? So he's all of a sudden he's sharing profits with all of his employees. Mm-hmm. And unlike the great relationship that King Oliver has with his 93-year-old grandmother, who, by the way, is from Mississippi and mm-hmm. does her own dishes when she's the girlfriend of the 91-year-old billionaire. Mm-hmm. He's got a great relationship with his daughter. And let's just say Roger Ferris's kids don't have the same kind of relationship with him that, mm-hmm. you know, that King Oliver has with his grandmother, with his cousin, the Merck, you know, with his daughter. And so you look at it and say, this guy has billions, but the value of the relationship that I see that Joe King Oliver has with his family is so much more important than the billions that Roger Ferris has.
Yeah, no, and I think it's true, you know, because when you're a kid, you can't really appreciate capitalism. What you do is you appreciate love. Somebody loves you. Somebody cares about you. Somebody respects you, you know, and treats you, you know, as another human being. You don't have to be equal. You don't have to be in all that stuff. But because we're all human beings, we have to be respected on that level. And, you know, that's where, you know, Joe comes from as you know, flawed a character as he is. And Roger Ferris, he doesn't come from there, and he doesn't come from a world that appreciates equality. And that's the way that life is. I think that when he met when Roger Ferris met Joe's grandmother, he he said, well, I want to go out with you. Now, he's the richest man in the world. When the richest man in the world tells a woman he wants to go out with him, they say yes. And she said, well, I'll go out with you, but I won't kiss you goodnight because, you know, you a white man and I don't kiss white men, you know. And, you know, that there's that thing. You say, oh, my God. Equality is something completely different than I've always thought.
And Brenda is so independent of mine. You know, when they're having dinner there, she doesn't let the servants do the dishes. She wants to do the dishes. So you build this character as a woman who continues to be who she is, no matter what the surroundings are.
Yeah. Well, you know, you take it with you and you learn, you know. I think Roger has helped her very much, but it's not because he's rich. It's because he dances with her every day. And that physically brings her to, you know, to a higher level in her life. I think that you know, it's a very complex series of relationships. You know, I mean, he has his friend, you know, the old dispatch sergeant from the NYPD, the guy who betrayed him in the previous book. But
helping him out, they work together too.
Say what?
Yeah, helping him out. I'm like, wow, this is. I'm like, this is pretty interesting. Your foe yesterday could be your friend today.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the world we live in, you know, and it's how you make it, you know.
I did like the fact that while he was visiting the mansion of this billionaire, he thought about his grandparents' Coldwater Shack mm-hmm. in Jackson, Mississippi, and just having a sense of how far he came and being able to think about that at that point in time in the novel. And so for me, part of this book is really, I think you may have said earlier, it's about class and, you know, the issues and privilege that comes with class and remembering who you are despite where you go. And one of the things that just kept coming up in my mind when thinking about Joe King Oliver is a character who speaks truth to power, which is a mm-hmm. phrase when I worked for the NAACP.
Yeah.
And I was used quite a bit, but it's just a trait of where no matter how high someone is, no matter how important they may think they are, no matter how important society may think they are, that right. you, every man is a king.
Yeah. All right. And that's our world, you know, that's our world. And also, you know, in a way, if you were to say, well, what's this book about? You said, well, it's about class and it's about love. And you know, money means a lot, capitalism, property, all that stuff. But without love, if you don't have love, then you don't have anything. You know, and it's true for Roger Ferris. It's true for Brenda. It's true for Joe King Oliver. You know, as a daughter, man, she's mad as hell at him for representing the, you know, this white nationalist. She can't take it. And, you know, and she's yelling at him about it, and he's loving her for yelling at him, you know. And she's feeling that love. You know, I mean, there's that so such a complex world. I mean, listen, I know I write in genre. I know I don't always do it. But, you know, this is one of my books in genre. But listen, the job of a novel is to talk about the world that we live in, the world that we're coming to, the world that we're approaching. And if you can do those things, well, you know, you wrote a novel.
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of the crime fiction writers, especially yourself, really do a much better job of dealing with the social issues and class issues and privilege issues of society as a whole than literary novelists. Mm-hmm. That if I want to read about someone who takes into consideration all the issues and the challenges we face in society with class, with race, with justice, for me at least, based on the scope of work I've been reading, I'm much more likely to find that addressed in a crime fiction novel mm-hmm. of the novelists I read. Than yeah. in the literary fiction that I read.
No, listen, I think a lot of shit. I mean, some literary fiction is great. It kind of like verges on genre. Like for instance, the Dostoevsky, The Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment. I mean, these are great novels, you know. But there's something going on, you know, with a crime or, you know, with a disaster, you know, and it's interesting about books. I mean, I've been saying this a lot lately. You know, when I wrote my second book about writing the elements of fiction, I have a chapter in there in which, you know, I get very unhappy with the university, thinking that it owns writing, thinking that it's the arbiter of writing, thinking that, you know, they can tell you what's good and what's not good. And I would say, well, you can tell me what's good and not good in the past. But what's going on today, you can't, because you don't know what's going on today. Nobody knows. We're creating the world as we work. These writers talking to each other. And I'm, you know, it bothers me sometimes about the university and so-called literary writing. You know, I am going, well, you know, OK, fine. You know, it's well written, you know. But, you know, one of the greatest American novels is Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser. And that book is not really very well written, but it's a great novel. And it's insightful well beyond its years. You know, you can't tell me, oh, this is good writing because, you know, I did good grammar, you know, because I made the words, you know, move beautifully, you know, that's fine. But what are you saying? You know,
I absolutely agree with you. I had an argument years ago with someone who was an English major and they were criticizing a book I was a fan of. I can't remember the name of, but all I thought about was how this book had the emotional impact the book had on me mm-hmm. and the ideas that it expressed. No, they didn't do all the fancy literary stuff. And you know, I haven't started writing, but all I knew was that it spoke to me. And if a novel speaks to your heart, speaks yeah. to your mind, yeah. heart or mind, makes you curious about things. Mm-hmm. So I'm pulling out your novel and I'm saying, okay, is there truly a three-fifths movement?
Yeah.
The alt-right. So the character is supporting this concept. Basically, the character that Joe King Oliver is helping, Alfred Xavier Quiller, believes that Blacks only deserve three-fifths of the right, but they have to prove themselves of rights to get more. And I said, did Walter find that out there or did he make that up? What is it?
Well, let me tell you, I was two Christmases ago, I was at a family dinner and it happened to be Angela Davis's family. And Angela was there. And I said, well, you know, he says that, you know, women and black people only get three fifths of a vote. And she went, oh, you mean like in slave times when the enslaved were only considered three fifths human. You know, so it's that, you know, that was that. And she was right. I mean, I was like, you know, because most people don't, you know, that's not exactly taught in school, especially in Florida. And you go, but yeah, this is our history. It's a part of our history. And of course, Alfred Xavier Quiller understands that, and which is why he tries to impose that, you know, through his philosophical writings. And, you know, it's why, you know, so many people hate him. Yeah, but yes, I'm not sure what people are doing today. I'm sure. I actually, when I wrote it in the book, I got a little worried. I said, well, I don't want to start people doing this. <You know? laughs> But then I thought, well, you know, it's so good. I got to put it in there. You know.
Well, what I do know that you apparently researched was there's an issue with diesel fuel. I won't give any more than that, but there's a diesel fuel issue that's associated with his ex-wife's husband, who's an investment banker.
Yeah.
And I looked it up and I said, this is real.
Yeah. 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 The dichotomy between so-called diesel fuel and so-called heating fuel, it's two molecules different, and you have to impose that. And, you know, one costs half as much as the other. And, you know, the real criminals, that's where they're making their money.
So there's something that happened this year that was really exciting. Crime Writers of Color won the Raven Award from the Mystery Writers of America.
Yeah, yeah.
You're one of the founders of the Crime Writers of Color.
Yeah.
We've really seen a lot of changes with the Mystery Writers of America that over the past 10 years, all of a sudden, there's much greater recognition of writers of color that, frankly, really wasn't there much.
Listen, maybe 20 years ago, I don't know if it's quite 20. I think it is 20 years ago. Every fourth or fifth, you know, Edgar winner, you know, Grandmaster Award went to a woman. Fourth or fifth. Half the writers are women of, you know, in crime writing, but it took 4 or 5 years. So they got so mad that the women, they went out and started Sisters in Crime. And they start giving their own awards, and all the women joined that organization. A lot of them stopped being in the Mystery Writers of America. Mystery Writers of America said, "Oh, we lost half of our impact here. We got to get them back." And all of a sudden, after Sisters in Crime started, when you start to look at who won the Master's Award, every other year it was a woman, because they realized. And you know, Kelly Garrett and I, you know, got together and, you know, with a couple of other people and said, well, you know, we need a crime writers of color, you know, not just black people, all kinds of, you know, people who are considered not white, whatever that means. And I think it's had a big impact. I mean, the mystery writers had already started to work with us because Sisters in Crime had an impact on them. But the idea that you have to force these people. That's why, you know, Martin Luther King doing the bus boycott. You know, he said, well, OK, fine. We just won't ride your bus. If we got to sit in the back, we ain't going to ride the bus. And that changed everything. Because the people who own the buses said, listen, man, we got to get that money. Now, you sure you can't sit next to them? Because, you could stand and we could get our money. And I just love it. I mean, I think that, you know, that it's a part of America that to say, well, we're going to organize and we're going to see what you think about that.
Because I was going through the list and like, OK, I'll confess that I was reading Iceberg Slim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, Chester Himes. But the point is that there are all these writers that they just never recognize.
When I got the award, I had to say, well, listen, there's Donald Goins, there's Ishmael Reed, there's Iceberg Slim, there's Chester Himes. All of these are great crime writers. They're great crime writers. How could they not, you know, how could not one of them get this award? You know, when I got the Grand Master, you know, from Mr. Writers of America, I was the first Black man to get it. And when I got the National Book Award, Grand Master, I was the first Black man to get it. I mean, you know, lifetime achievement. And you know, these are things, you know, and you know, and if nobody organizes and stands up for us, nothing's ever going to happen. So, you know, we did it. We started Crime Writers of Color. I think there's over 350 members now. Wow. You know, all of them working together, all of them doing stuff. So the mystery writers, they had to recognize it. You know, we're like doing a new thing, you know, and it didn't come out of anything that somebody offered us. We just did it.
So let's talk about how busy you are. So I got this pulled up right here. 2018, Down the River Unto the Sea. 2020, Trouble Is What I Do. 2021, Blood Grove. 2023, Every Man a King. And then there's television.
Mm-hmm.
So to what degree these novels were already percolating and were just taking a while to gestate and to get them into the mix? Because I know famously, as you've said in my interview and other interviews, you write almost every day.
Yeah, every day.
So, but this has been a particularly fruitful seasons for you for the past 5 years.
There's even a couple of more books in there that got published. Awkward Black Man is certainly one, but
John Woman.
Yeah. But about 7 years ago, John Singleton, a truly great individual, called me and he said, "Walter, I'm doing this thing called Snowfall. I need you in the writer's room." And I said, "John, it sounds like a great show, but I don't know anything about writing television." He said, "That's okay, brother. Just come in the room and back me up. You know, you don't have to write anything." And I said, "Okay." You know, now, like, we just finished the last season, you know, writing last season. And, you know, I'm an executive producer. You know, it's like really very cool. I did another show called The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, based on one of my novels with Sam Jackson on Apple TV. Right now, I'm trying to do three or four different shows. We're shooting a movie, I think, of mine based on my novel, The Man in My Basement, in Wales. We're shooting it. In April, if everything goes right, I think it's going to happen. So I'm very busy. I work every day. I love writing. I love the world. I like working in television. It's collaborative, so it's not as much fun as writing novels or fiction, but you know, you just keep on doing it and you just keep committed to the work that you're doing. Cause it's easy to get a job doing something you don't like. It's easy to get a job, you know, betraying yourself or your people or whatever. It's a little harder when, you know, you're doing something, you know, trying to tell your own truth. Now, I don't know if other people agree with my truth or if I agree with theirs, but I think if you stick to who you are and what you're doing, that's always a good thing. And so, I'm having a great time writing. And, you know, there's the 60 books I've done and, you know, I hope there's another 30, you know, but it's a lot.
Everyone thinks when they think Walter Mosley, the first thing that comes to mind is E.Z. Rollins.
Yeah.
But I think Leonard McGill. Now I think Joaquin Oliver. I remember the character who you described. His hands were like concrete or hit like concrete.
And oh, Fearless Jones.
Fearless Jones.
Yeah.
And I think about the Lawrence Fishburne. The guy was on.
Socrates.
Socrates Fortlow.
Yeah.
Former ex-con, right?
Yeah.
So I think about all these different books you wrote. And is there cross-fertilization? Do you find any cross-fertilization writing in so many different genres, nonfiction, political, or are they all siloed?
Well, you know, the reason I write different kinds of books is because I'm telling different kinds of stories. You know, sometimes whatever the problem is, it's a mystery that has to get solved. Sometimes it's existential. It's an internal way that I attach myself to the world. Sometimes it's purely and simply erotic. You know, I mean, whatever I'm doing,
yes.
You know, I try to find it. And of course, everything is the same. You know, I mean, like, you know, a good book is a good book. It's not like, You know, well, what genre is it? You know, because like people in literary fiction, I said, well, you know, people in literary fiction have genres. The coming of age genre, for instance, you know, the getting old and not being able to function anymore genre, you know, and there's a lot of romance, too. You know, the love genre, you know, I mean, we have all these things, you know, and it's just the question isn't what it's about. It's how well it's written and how well it gets the idea across. Those two things, which don't necessarily go together, but hopefully they do.
So my last question, I was wondering, when you start the next novel in a series,
yeah,
do you go back and reread that novel to sort of figure out where you want to go next?
Yes, I do. I go back sometimes, you know, I do because I never, you know, when people do the audios, I don't usually, you know, they say, well, do you want to check out this guy and make sure he's doing it right? I said, no, that's your job. You make sure he's doing it right. I'm writing my book. But when I do a new book, if the book has been in audio, I usually listen to it, you know. Like, you know, because I've already written it, you know, 10 or 12 times over. So then I listen to it. And that's good enough because I just need to know what the story is, you know, and what the characters were and stuff. I just did that. I'm writing a new Easy Rollins right now, you know, and I just went back over Blood Grove to make sure that, you know, the new one's going to be good.
Oh, I absolutely loved Blood Grove. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, Every Man It Came by Walter Mosley. Absolutely love this novel. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
It's great to see you, Hope, then. It's wonderful. I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.